Blog Talk Radio.
How is everyone? This is the latest episode of Graphic Policy Radio, where comic books and the multiverses meet. As always, I'm one of your hosts, Brett, and with me is Alana and Ken.
How's it going?
Hi.
Tonight we've actually got a special guest coming up at about 8:15. Ron Mars is going to call in, and we're going to talk about his comic book career and his latest release, Voodoo, with DC Comics. But I figured before that, we might as well talk DC releases and what we thought about the last batch of all the new stuff that DC has put out.
Well, I've decided to only buy the ones that I'm actually interested in reading.
So what do you want to...
Did you guys take a look at Firestorm this week?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. It was good. It was definitely, like, there was a lot of focus on character.
Yeah.
Which was good. It seemed to be the kind of a theme this week with a lot of people discussing a lot of focus on the character as opposed to a lot of action.
Yeah, and I think that that's fine, especially with a character who people don't know anything about primarily with Firestorm. I thought it had some good commentary on race in the book. It wasn't as good as, you know, the stuff she was writing, that Gail Simone was writing before the new You, but I also know that first issues can be harder to really show depth in, so I'll definitely pick it up next week. I mean, I think that the parallel panels of the black teenager and the white teenager at dinner with their families was a nicely handled sequence, and you know, she's someone whose work I really respect. But I still miss Secret Six. I can't get over it. Did you guys read Justice League Dark?
My biggest problem with Firestorm was the ending, where it kind of, I was like, what just happened? I was following along fine, and I thought the stuff about race was great. The line where the young white quarterback asks his mom why we don't have any black friends, I thought was one of the more powerful little things that I've seen on race in a comic in a long time. But at the end,
yeah,
I was like, what happened in this comic book? I have no idea what happened at the last couple of panels there, so it kind of baffled me at the end.
I mean, I don't want to spoiler anybody, but I actually thought I kind of do know. It's sort of think Voltron, I guess, is the closest I can say. But I see how that could be confusing.
Yeah, there was a little change in the character. I mean, before it was the two of them would form Firestorm together, and then there was this weird thing at the end where they kind of got together. So, I mean, that was it was definitely changed up on the character, so...
Wait, so Firestorm was always Voltron?
Well, no, like, I mean, he used to be, from what I remember, for at least from the Brightest Day, where I kind of knew the character, was he was the dude, the two of them, like, merged together, and they would form Firestorm. I could be totally wrong on that, but that's what I remember from Brightest Day. So, I mean, the ending kind of played off of that, but then there was, like, this twist to it that kind of came out of nowhere.
And I haven't read Firestorm since the 80s, so I remember, like, the second character being, like, dead and actually being inside the first character and not, like, any kind of merging thing, so it threw me off just because I haven't read it in such a long time.
I've never read it in my life, so everything I know is from inference.
What else out of the latest batch did y'all like or dislike?
Justice League Dark was better on the second read, I felt. Maybe it was even the third one. It didn't really have the sort of humor that I thought he might have in his writing. It did have some really interesting descriptions and turns of phrase that were, you know, it was good. I mean, I didn't love it, but it was good. The cover art was beautiful. You know, got a nice range of female characters in there doing real things.
Yeah, the interior art bothered me a little bit. I don't think it was quite as solid as a lot of the other series that came out.
It wasn't as good as the cover, especially. I wish they could just have the cover artist, you know, spend the time they needed to do everything.
It was good enough that I'm going to read issue two. Like, it grabbed me enough that I want to know more, which a lot of the 52 hasn't done that. But Justice League Dark did that, and I think that was one of the weaker comic books this week, but it still was good enough to make me want to read issue two. And I was going to say, I think this week was, of the 4 weeks, was by far the strongest week. There wasn't anything really horrible, and almost everything was interesting enough to read again, and there was some really, really good stuff. So I think this is the best week of the four. So,
which was the best comic this week?
I Vampire. Yeah. I would go with I Vampire as the best one of all 52, personally. I mean, it was just, one, it was beautiful. Every panel on every page was just great, great art. And the story took something that, you know, it's really kind of a genre that's run into the ground, you know, vampire stuff and you know, vampires mixing in with, you know, mainstream heroes has also been done to death. You know, the X-Men crossover with the vampires they just did. So it's been something that's really, really difficult to do something new and interesting with, and they really did something new and interesting with it. And I thought that was one of maybe the best vampire comic I've ever read. So,
does it really exist in the DC universe? I didn't actually read, didn't read that one. Or
yeah,
more,
yeah.
Or is it more standalone?
Yeah, and not only deals with the DC universe, but there seems to be a nice tie-in where the future conflict is going to be the vampires basically pissed off at the heroes are taking over the world, and they think that they should do it instead.
Huh.
So I actually think...
Well, I'll tell you, my store was sold out of it. That's the reason I didn't pick it up.
Yeah, I mean, the good ones was... I, Vampire, I think, was one of the best that came out, period. And I actually really liked Aquaman. That one shocked me.
Yeah, exactly. And I just read your review a little while ago, and my reaction was exactly the same as yours. And they're like, all right, this is Aquaman. This is like DC's weakest character, and he's such a joke. And then they went directly at those exact same jokes and stereotypes about him and just made something really fun and entertaining and funny and serious, too. There was a serious part in it, too. It's, you know, it sets a new paradigm for the Aquaman universe or whatever. And it was just, I was really surprised and really enjoyed it, so...
Yeah, and I couldn't help feel it by the end of it. I felt bad for him.
Yeah.
Like, I actually came away and was like, oh, I shouldn't have been making fun of him.
It's funny, too, because he was talking to a blogger in the middle of the comic, so that was that added an extra layer of humor for those of us who are bloggers who have made fun of Aquaman before, so.
but yeah, I mean, this
I've never
cool.
made fun of him before.
I always have.
But I did think that the panels that they had in Hollywood Reporter during Comic-Con were so, like, meh, middling. I mean, were those actually in the final comic?
I don't remember what they teased, but I think so. I mean, it was one of those things, like, he walks into he wants to go grab something to eat, and he walks into a fish restaurant, and they're like, can you be here? And then even the cops were like, great, I just got shown up by Aquaman.
The brilliant thing to me was the line where he actually, like one of the other diners actually says, don't you talk to fish? And then he, you know, goes into the line about, you know, fish don't have brains where they could do that. So no, of course I don't talk to fish. I thought that was just funny. One of the funniest things in the entire, you know, DC lineup. So.
Yeah. I mean, it was really, really solid comic. I think it was up there, I think, as one of the best ones overall as well.
But say that again. I just didn't hear you.
I thought it was one of the best ones overall as well.
I was going to say even better than Aquaman, though, I thought was All-Star Western, which was also a surprise because I totally didn't expect that at all.
Yeah, I mean, my thing with All-Star Western was the story's not original. I mean, it's basically Jack the Ripper. And even very much feels like From Hell.
Yeah.
But it was nice to see taking Jonah Hex and really kind of moving him into the DCU in a very creative way. But it was really good. I actually think the best part of All-Star Western was the use of Arkham and having him commenting on Hex and kind of his psychology through it all. And the small things that he was picking up about the character. Like it was a great addition and a great way to kind of introduce you to the character and overall storytelling.
Yeah, it was very much, I think, in addition to the Jack the Ripper stuff, which I kind of liked, because, I mean, there's only so many stories you can tell, and so it's very common that you're going to have stories that are retellings of older things, and that's one of the better retellings of Jack the Ripper I've ever seen. But it also mixed in, I mean, there's some very clear Sherlock Holmes elements there as well, and the tie-in to, like, all the history of Gotham, and, you know, there's a character named Cobblepot, there's a character named Wayne, and there's, you know, it's clearly, like, they're fully, you know, really talking about Gotham just as much as they're talking about Jonah Hex. In fact, I think Jonah Hex may be the least important character in the issue, which is fine, because he's the most problematic character in terms of, like, you know, he's kind of very much your very stereotypical tough guy Western character. And while he was good in this, it's part of that's probably because they underused him and played up Arkham and some of the other characters, which I thought was a good way to go. So,
yeah, that was one thing I really liked as well, was the fact that they really tied in some of the characters. There was Cobblepot and Wayne and all those guys. It was interesting. It made it like a very, very interesting read.
And art was very, very good too.
Yeah, it's not my favorite type of art, but it was good. Like, there were some panels where I had issues, but overall it was a different style, which was the other thing I noticed this week, was there was a lot of variation in the styles of the various comics.
Yeah.
So any of the issues this week that you read that you disliked?
Not horribly, but I'd say probably my least favorite, and I knew going in that was going to be my least favorite, was Savage Hawkman. I just, like, I've never read an issue of Hawkman where I liked the character, so I don't, it's like, it's not much they could do with it to make me like it. And in addition to that, the issue had some real problems. I mean, the very first page has, you know, his human alter ego shooting the Hawkman suit. And the idea of shooting an inanimate costume just to me seemed like really, really dumb, even if it was magical or alien or whatever it is. It just seemed like there are a lot of ways you could try to destroy it if that was what you were trying to do, but to shoot a costume just struck me as kind of really dumb, and there were some other problems after that, but that's really set off a bad tone to me, and it didn't really improve from there from what I read. But I mean, it wasn't horrible or anything like that, but I have no interest in reading issue two, so...
Yeah, that was another. I kind of walked out. I was like, okay, this is okay, but it's not, and it's not bad in any way. It's just wasn't for me to like really pick up. And Superman was the same way. I was really disappointed in that. And kind of fascinated that this is supposed to be, you know, one of their pillars, and it just, I don't think it was good.
See, I think that's the one we disagree on the most, because it seemed to me like the whole issue was very much a throwback style. It was very, very heavy on, you know, text box exposition and stuff like that, you know, like every comic in the 60s, 70s, and 80s was. And, you know, it had, you know, dialogue and everything, but in addition to the dialogue, there was tons and tons of other writing there, and it was in a very, you know, old-school style, and I thought in that context, it was a good homage to that stuff. Not surprising, I think, coming from George Perez, but I did agree with you, like the final resolution with the threat, the conflict in there was kind of a bit of a letdown, but I liked the style so much that it wasn't as big a deal to me that the story wasn't as compelling as it could have been.
Yeah, I think my issue with it was I liked the style, I disliked the story. Like I liked the way the story was laid out and the mechanisms that were used to tell it. Like it was told as a newspaper article, that I liked, but to me the first issue needs to be magical, amazing, especially for Superman, and it just wasn't. And then like him himself, Kent, just seemed like a brooding, quiet guy when he was on page, and like a lot of it was more focused on the Daily Planet than Superman. So I think that was my issues with it.
And there were a few shots that kind of paralleled action and made Clark Kent look like Harry Potter. So I'm really not up with the Harry Potter Clark Kent thing. If that's intentional or unintentional, that they need to change his glasses or something, because he looks like Harry Potter, and I'm tired of it.
Yeah, that was definitely an issue for me throughout the issue, or as far as the art. Like, there was just something just wasn't clicking for me. But, I mean, overall, like, this week was really solid. But speaking of this week, we've got Ron Mars. Let me call him. Cross my fingers that this works. Ron?
It works, apparently.
Hey, that's fantastic. You're the first one we've ever had as a guest, so it was a big cross my fingers whether or not this would work. So thank you, and
so if
welcome.
If this goes
to
horribly wrong, it's my fault, right?
Well, there's three of us, so it probably is going to be all on us. So I don't know if you've been listening, but it's not just me that does the radio show. With me is Alana and Ken. Is our co-host,
hey,
and Ron Mars is on the air with us.
Thanks for joining the show.
So this is like live and in person. There's no. Is there a 7-second delay? Because you know,
no.
I'm prone to swearing.
No swearing.
Half, so.
Clearly, you haven't listened to this show because there's no.
So
delay.
I would be swearing a lot more if the Giants hadn't won today. So.
I won my first. It looks like I'm going to win my first fantasy game, so I'm very happy. In 2 weeks, I've gone 0-3.
It's week 4, right?
Yep, I've gone 0-3 in 2 different leagues. So
excellent. Well, apparently you're what they call the Patsy game.
Yes, it's just hasn't been a good season for me. So, but we're not talking fantasy football. We're talking comics here. And you, out of everyone who has seen so much over the years, and it's kind of fascinating that right now you're basically writing for 3 different companies. You've got Shinku, and you're doing some work with Deadlands, which is being published by Image. You're wrapping up on Witchblade, but you got Magdalena and Artifacts with Top Cow, and this week actually saw the release of Voodoo with DC. So. It's just interesting that we can, I think, first just talk about the differences between working for 3 different publishing companies. Is the style?
Well, not really. I mean, essentially, I do what I do, and they hopefully hire me for what I do. So the specifics aren't too different. The one difference is that everybody wants to be the first guy in the deadline line. Do my thing first. So that's a bit of a juggling act. But I've been doing this for a number of years, so I kind of understand how it works. And, you know, you basically have to keep everybody that you're working for satisfied in terms of the workflow. In terms of the work specifics, obviously something like Shinku is creator-owned. It's completely mine and Lee Motors, who is the artist on the book. So we do what we want, how we want. With something like Voodoo at DC, obviously you're working in a, you're working with corporate characters in a large universe. So there are certain strictures that you have to abide by, and that there's going to be some editorial give and take on any given issue. That's just part of the process. I'm always kind of baffled when I see writers pissing and moaning that they were doing work for hire comics and they were given editorial notes. Well, hey, stupid, that's what they do. They don't just let you come in and break all the toys and play with them however you want. You have to understand that when you go into this, you're going to be given freedom within reason, but ultimately they're not yours. So, and you have to make your peace with that ahead of time. If your nose is out of joint because of the notes you're getting back, unless it's something that's, really kind of antithetical to what you're trying to do, it's just part of the process. So, each book that I do has a little bit different character and a little bit different take, particularly in terms of the artists that I work with. But company to company, it's not vastly different, really.
So I think we'll start with the Top Cow stuff. So you're wrapping up your run on Witchblade, which has been going on for quite a while. I mean, it's what, close to 100 issues?
When we publish issue 150, that will be issue, what is that, 70 in a row for me?
All right, 70, so plus.
Plus various miniseries and tie-ins and stuff like that. So,
how's it feel wrapping up this series after a hell of a run?
It's, you know, I was going to say it's bittersweet, but that's actually bullshit. It's not bittersweet. It's, you know, you kind of feel bad about it because it's kind of like you're letting somebody else date your girl. And, you know, I'm sure that I will get used to the idea as we go, but there is a little bit of separation anxiety when you're walking away from a book that you've had a good run on and that you feel like you still have some more stories to tell. That being said, you always want to walk away while you still have stories to tell, and not, you know, not after you've really reached the, you know, the bottom of the well.
Any chance that there will be more stories to tell coming from you when it comes to Witchblade? Or,
well, because we're continuing Artifacts at Top Cow as a regular monthly series, and that's where Stjepan Sejic, who is my artist on Witchblade, and I are going together, you will certainly see us doing stories with Sarah in the context of the Artifacts ongoing series. There will be other characters in the mix, and you will certainly see Jackie Estacado, who is the Darkness, as well as Tom Judge and Tilly, who are in Artifacts right now. So it's more of a rotating cast, but there will be a fairly solid base of Jackie and Sarah appearances too.
Was there so Artifacts, from my understanding, when it came out, was planned was to be a limited series. It was basically this event. Was there thoughts of keeping it on as an ongoing, or is it always supposed to be an event and it just worked out so well that it was like, hey, we're going to do this ongoing?
Yeah, we actually, you know, the idea was, look, let's do 13 issues. We'll tell a complete story. We won't have a bunch of tie-in chapters that sort of, you know, put a gun to the reader's head and say, you know, here you got to go read all these miniseries as well. We just wanted to contain it to the Artifacts series itself. And when it did real well and it seemed to be clicking creatively, Philip Sablik, and who was the editor and publisher at Top Cow, and Matt Hawkins, who is the president, came to me and said, you know, what do you think about just keeping this going after we get, you know, after issue 13 wraps up the initial storyline? And I had to kind of get used to the idea for a little bit, but now that that's settled in and the notion has really started to appeal to me, because we've got a lot of different stories we can tell. And, you know, issue 13 of Artifacts has a very definite conclusion to it. It has a very definite feeling of completion, but it also, hopefully, like all good stories, you know, it lays out a bunch of different possibilities for where we can go with it. So the notion of continuing it seemed like a pretty good fit, and I'm, you know, anytime I can work with Stjepan, it's, you know, it's a good day. So I'm looking forward to it.
And you're still doing Magdalena for Top Cow?
Yes, as long as we can keep Magdalena going, I will be doing it. And, you know, the sales are sort of hovering on the blink, so everybody on the brink, rather. So everybody should go buy at least two copies of the next few issues.
So I guess so. You went from so you've had history with DC. You were basically or notoriously, depending on who you ask, kind of in the thick of things when it came to Green Lantern and some major upheaval and changes with there. But how did you get involved going back to DC and specifically on Voodoo, which debuted this week?
Very simply, they called. They called earlier this year and said, hey, do you want to do this book? And I said, well, can I think about it? And they said, no, not really. You need to decide sooner rather than later. So I thought about it and looked at my schedule and figured out that it wasn't really gonna work schedule wise. And then I said yes anyway.
So when they approached you about writing the book, like, did you have a sense of what angle they wanted you to take with it, or did they sort of leave you be?
Not really. It was pretty wide open when they said, here's what we're doing. Here's the character. And the general concept was kind of an espionage or, alias. Whenever I say alias, I have to be careful to reference the TV show rather than the Marvel series. That general feel for the book. But there were no real marching orders beyond that. They kind of left it in my hands to come up with something and run with it, assuming they liked it. And so far, so good.
I mean, because I have to admit, like, as a comics reader, when I hear that they're assigning a title that's starring a female character that has, it's so easy to tell her story wrong that I was frankly, like, scared to pick up the book in the first place. Given the fact that there's so few female leads right now and there's, like, two women writing comics for the mainstream publishers, I was just like, I don't know if I can do this. I definitely picked up the book because Brett was said that, like, that you were a really good writer and that I needed to check it out, so I did. But did you have a sense that, like, there was going to, I mean, because the controversies that have come out this week with a lot of people of both genders expressing their concern with how women as an audience are being ignored by the new DC releases, like, I know you weren't expecting to hear all of that when you started working on it, but I know that, the character Voodoo herself, like, as a guy, you must have had some sort of concern about writing that.
Not really. I mean, why would I? I'm a writer. I make shit up. That's my job. I'm not a silver alien who rides on his spaceboard, but I made up 50 issues of that. I'm not a guy that has a all-powerful magic ring that lets him do anything he wants, but I wrote 70 issues of that. I made it up. I don't really understand the criticism of you're a guy, so you shouldn't write a female character, or you're a woman, so you shouldn't write a male character.
It's not that you shouldn't do it, but that it's just a particularly difficult one to be taking on.
I know what you're saying, but
I think
people get their back up needlessly about this stuff. To me, ultimately, the sex of the writer has very little to do with the success of the book. To me, what has to do with the success of the book, the play, the movie, whatever it is the talent level of the people involved. I've seen plenty of times where a man was hired to do something and, to write a female character and completely sucked at it. I've also seen instances where women were hired to write males or females and they sucked at it. Didn't have anything to do with the fact that they were a woman. Had to do with the fact that they just didn't get the job right. I kind of bristle at the notion of, well, what's a man really doing writing a character like this anyway? And I know that's not what you're saying, but I think sometimes people forget that that's what writers do. We make up stuff. We create imaginary people. And I think if you're good at what you do, you should be able to imagine a completely formed male character or a completely formed female character or alien or elf or troll or whatever it is. Even though you haven't walked in those shoes, that's what the job is.
I mean, to me, she works as an alien in this book. I don't actually read her as being female in her interactions with the people. I think you successfully wrote her as an alien, I do, for real, which I think is, you've written Silver People, so I suppose that makes sense. But I have to say, even with that, I am concerned at how the next few issues have been packaged with the cover for issue 4, and it's like, you're trying to do a book that is about a story, but it looks like cover 4 is about her boobs exclusively. And I know it's not too late, it's December, it's a while away. So I don't know if this means that it's set in stone, but I was like, if I look at it, I mean, I it's hard for me to say that that's the thing I would want to buy. It makes me feel embarrassed almost.
Well,
it's like, oh, if you want to look at a picture of breasts.
Well, two
and
things.
Actually, you're telling a story about an alien invading Earth.
I don't paint covers, so, you know, you can take that for whatever it's worth.
I know.
But to me, everybody loses their minds when there's some sort of sexy imagery in comics, right? But when it's in a magazine ad, nobody bats an eye. You know,
well, I mean,
if you took the same imagery that's on, say, that cover to number 4 of Voodoo and put it on a magazine ad, nobody would say a word because we're so used to the media bombarding us with sexual imagery. It's kind of become commonplace. Now, I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I'm just saying that I think ultimately the kind of media we get reflects who we are as a society.
Which is true, but I think that's why we need to do better. I mean, this is a medium where there's a much closer relationship between the fans and the creators than in advertising, where they really don't care what we think.
Right, but so, I mean, here, ultimately, you guys vote with your dollar. I mean, that's ultimately what publishers care about. If people are going to piss and moan and bitch and complain about, you know, a sexy cover on a book and buy it anyway.
It's not something sexy though. I mean, sexy isn't the problem, but it's very much like there's a certain, I mean, I know you're not going to comment about the whole Starfire thing because like you can't, but like to me, on no level is the Starfire comic sexy. It is like insulting to people who like sex because it's telling this woman like, oh, you want to go have sex on me?
We were discussing a cover, and now you're discussing the interiors. To me, those are two different things. They work together to present an overall impression, but I don't think you can jump from what a cover on one of my books looks like to the interiors of a book that I didn't write and I didn't read. As part of the same discussion.
You didn't read it?
No. I've seen the...
I mean, I figured you're not
going to
read it anyway.
I've seen the pages, certainly, because everybody's seen the pages. And frankly, you know, it seems over the top to me, but I haven't read the whole thing in context, so I'm not going to defend it, and I'm not going to decry it one way or the other, because to me, having an opinion on something that you haven't even read makes you look like an idiot. So I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to come down on one side or the other. I do understand the outcry. I do understand why people come at it with this, with sort of a chip on their shoulder already, because there's been a, you know, there's been a history of less than equal portrayals of women in comics.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe that's the PC way to put it.
Yeah, and I guess that
know,
was my concern is that everything you're doing is coming through that lens. Like, because there is this history, you have to think about what, you know, what people write and how it's going to be read by, and how it's going to be read by women and men in the audience. Like, because it's always going to have that. It's always going to have that history to it.
Well, right, but every, you know.
So
but,
I'm more careful, you know.
So are you saying that I should be more careful about the kind of stories I write because of stories by other people that I didn't write?
Well, no, I think that if we're talking about making comics something that isn't just enjoyed by the same, you know, I mean, I have been having a really hard time with the relaunch, as I'm sure is true of a lot of people. So, and I know that you're only writing your book, and I don't want to get off to talking too much about stuff that, like, you have nothing to do with at all. But I do think that creators should remember when they're creating their work that there is a, you know, that their book isn't the first thing that's ever come out, and that, like, anything you create, especially you're drawing on the past of stories, and you're drawing on what we've all seen and experienced in comics so far, and that there's a lot of problems. you know, when I write about those things, I take those concerns as well.
Right, but I'm not, you know, I'm ultimately not sure what your point is. Do you want the stuff written like it's always been written? Or, I mean, you know,
no.
On the one hand, you're saying
I
shouldn't be affected by what's come before, and on the other hand, you're saying...
Oh, no, I'm sorry. No, I was saying that we are. That, like, everything you write existed in the context of a comics industry that's been historically sexist and exclusionary to, you know, people of color in terms of other people.
Sure. And
comics.
So has, you know, and so has, you know, film and television and everything else. I'm not saying it's right, but I'm saying to single out comics as, you know, as the sexist boogeyman here is kind of being somewhat disingenuous because it's a societal problem, you know. And I know that we're specifically talking about comics. But,
exactly.
You know, for every person that goes nuts about, frankly, three comics out of 52 that got their nose out of joint, you know, you look at the stuff that's on TV and films and go, well, you know, why isn't anybody losing their mind over this stuff?
Bill, people are and do.
I don't know what that answer is. But I'm saying, you know, like, why was, you know, here's the way I look at it. A big segment of the audience lost their mind because we said an issue of a comic in a strip club, right? A male character was brutally murdered at the end of that issue. Nobody has said jack shit about it.
Well, I think that has to do with the norm of people getting brutally murdered
a lot. is the message then that violence is okay and sex isn't?
I definitely agree that there's a double standard and that violence is normal in comics and that sex isn't, for sure. But the character who got killed was threatening the life of your heroine, so
sure.
The audience is going to be okay with him getting killed. And I know that you may have tried to make her sort of ambiguous, but, you know, I'm not sure that's equivalent.
Well, my point is, why isn't anybody talking about it?
Because of the general problem that we're all seeing is, like, we want to talk about what's happened to the portrayal of women in comics in DC and the lack of female creators. So, because, you know, with something specific that happens that's violent
there's a female creator,
you know, we're not
going
to notice
there's
that.
There's a female creator coloring voodoo. Nobody's mentioned that either.
That's cool, and I actually think the coloring when they are, you know, was great, and the line and the you know, it's hard, right? Because, like, I'm like, on the one hand, this is beautiful art.
But my point in this discussion overall, and I don't mean you and I having a discussion. I mean the overall discussion of this issue hasn't been a discussion. It's been talking points because nobody actually wants to have a discussion. They just want to arrange the evidence so that it fits their preordained conclusion and put it in front of you, right? So that's where my difficulty with this is that people don't want to really have a discussion. The woman who dressed up as Batgirl at San Diego didn't want to have a discussion. She wanted to make accusations, right? And then the guy who stands up behind her and says, you know, you've gone from 12% to 2% of women working in the industry. Why did you do that? Everybody goes batshit, and it turns out those numbers are completely false. It was just something that, you know, because he apparently lacks math skills, he made up. And then we see those numbers reported in, you know, actual respectable media outlets.
I'm not going to get hung up on, like, the specific numbers, like, of percentages or whatever, and, you know, and the point is that it's still there are very, very, very few women creators, and you're
yes,
not making
absolutely,
those editorial decisions,
absolutely.
But it's not,
let's say this, if somebody says there are very few women creators, and they're only looking at Marvel and DC, they're not getting an actual picture.
You're not looking at everything else, right? But it's a question of who's getting hired. And sure, it means
it's a question of who's getting hired, and it's also a question of, you know, Marvel and DC do mainly superhero comics, by and large, right? Probably, if you added up Marvel and DC's content, it would be 85 to 90% superhero comics. You know, I think absolutely both companies and Dark Horse and Image and everybody else needs to do a better job of hiring female creators. But the flip side of that coin is, and you can hear this over and over again, there aren't as many female creators coming out for the jobs. The number of submissions that Image gets from female creators, I don't know the specific number that Eric Stevenson quoted, but it's very, very low.
But, you know, when I put together
conferences
and things like that, I go out of my way to make sure that I recruit folks. And, you know, because it's not that they're not there. It's that sometimes they're not the folks who you know about, or the folks who people know. I mean,
I'm saying that Image is an open submission process. Anybody can send their stuff in. If it's still a predominance of men that send their stuff into Image, you know, I don't see how you can damn the whole industry, because, you know, if those jobs aren't being applied for by women, it's hard to give
them.
But
if they want to expand the number of women who are reading comics, and of course, like, I mean, you know, we all seen that it's a huge percentage of readership anyway, but then they would make a point of trying to recruit for those roles. But, like, I mean, it's hard for me not to talk about this because this is stuff that really bothers me, but I also, like, you're not an editor, so this isn't ultimately, you know, your area, like, that you're running, and you're running your own book specifically. But, you know, it is that you need to make a point of recruiting people for those positions if you're not seeing enough coming into you.
But in the way that the comics industry work, and if you want specifics of, look, Marvel and DC go out, and generally, they're not taking submissions. They're the major leagues. You don't cold submit to Marvel and DC. They will come after you, right? The way that most people get into Marvel and DC is they do their self-published book, and they move up the ladder to doing an Image book and maybe a Dark Horse book. And eventually, you know, you send your stuff into Marvel and DC, or meet an editor at a convention, and you get pulled up to the big leagues if they want to give you the shot. My point here is that I think women have to go about getting jobs at Marvel and DC the same way that men do, which is you work your way up from, you know, the smaller publishers to someplace like Image.
You think it's just a coincidence that there are fewer women who have successfully moved through that system? I mean,
are you trying to portray me as stupid now? Or,
no, but like I don't understand.
Well, then don't bait me with silly questions. It's obviously not a coincidence. It's also obvious that, by and large, I don't think a lot of women read superhero comics. I think there's a growing segment that are reading superhero comics, but historically it's always been a male-dominated readership, and I think the readership ultimately spawns the people who, in the next generation, take over the jobs creatively, and I think we're in that process now.
Excellent.
And I already said, I think Marvel and DC have to do a much better job of hiring women, but there have to be women with the skills that Marvel and DC are looking for, and I think they are out there, and they are getting hired. There are more women working at Marvel and DC now than, as far as I'm concerned, ever before. And I've got probably a 20-year view from at least my perspective of being in the industry.
Brett has been one of the people who's actually trying to look at statistics of.
But you can't wave a magic wand and just say you have to hire more women. This is a small enough industry that when you say hire more women, you know, you can almost say, well, which women?
I guess that's a question. Well, I got a question on that. Was demographics ever discussed with you? Like, so DC has kind of hinted that the whole relaunch was to try to pull more people in and get more people reading comics. And we've had that discussion of, like, who are they trying to aim the stuff for, and whether or not there was some internal plan of, like, you know, we're having this series to hopefully grab this audience, this series to grab this audience. Was that ever discussed with you when putting together Voodoo?
No, the only thing in putting together Voodoo that was discussed with me was it's a teen plus book. So those are your parameters for sex, violence, and language.
Interesting.
But in terms of, you know, who we're targeting this for, there was no discussion of it whatsoever. It was just, you know, go write a comic that's, you know, that's appropriate for a teen plus audience.
And when, I mean, was that when you're writing kind of like what you went off of just, it's a teen plus, it stars this character with this history, I'm just going to kind of go with it, with this alias spy sort of feel to it? Or did you think about, like, this is kind of the group I want to go for? Or...
No, when I sit down to write something, my audience is me, because I'm the only one whose tastes I ultimately know. So I don't, you know, I don't ever, you know, sit here and say, what is my demographic? Who is my target? You know, because I think if you approach your job, your creative job, in that sense, you've already kind of whored yourself out. So I sat down and wrote the kind of story that I wanted to tell. And, you know, look, I took the aspect of her character from Wildcats that she was a stripper, and I set the first issue in a strip club, for good or ill. Obviously, some people have a big problem with the fact that it's set in a strip club, and other people are not so bothered by it.
Did that cross your mind at all when writing it? You sit there and was like, ooh, this might piss some people off?
Did it cross my mind? Yeah, I suppose it did, because I know, you know, look, we all know how fandom works and how comics works. Somebody's ultimately going to be pissed off about everything you do in comics. That's just kind of the nature of, you know, the nature of the business. But it's not like I sat here and went, ooh, let's set this in a strip club and push some buttons. You know, I wanted that touchstone for the previous incarnation of the character, but it wasn't like I sat here and thought, oh, you know, rubbed my hands together and thought, oh, let's make this sexy because we can sell extra copies that way. That's, you know,
but I thought your actual voiceover stuff that you did was a critique of, I mean, that's how I read it.
Yeah, that was actually going to be my next question, too, yeah.
I mean, that's why I was okay with it. Is that not intended as a
critique? It was like the first page and a half has the strip club DJ thing, like, you know, this is what you want. You're going to like it, so, like something of that nature. And it really, to me, felt like almost a critique of the reader. Being like, we're going to show you the TNA because we know this is generally what's been done. And to me, it was almost like a wink and kind of a meta feel on it.
Really, you know, there wasn't really any intended meta commentary there. To me, it was, you know, my intention with the first issue was that the reader is kept at arm's length from Voodoo herself for most of the issue. And because this is the first issue, there are obviously certain story elements that I, as the writer, had to get in there in terms of who she is, where she's coming from, just the basics, you know, the basic ground floor that you need to know. Now, I know from looking at some of the reviews, some people missed that stuff completely. They didn't really get why she was doing what she was doing, or, you know, exactly, you know, there are specific story reasons why she's stripping in that strip club located where it is.
Yeah, and I kind of picked up on that. And I thought the interesting to me was, I'm not quite sure she's the star of the comic. Like, it might be her name on it, but almost that the agent that was with, and I can't think of her name offhand, seems like she might be more of a focus or as much of a focus as Voodoo is.
Voodoo is the star of the comic. I would not go so far as to say she's the hero of the comic.
Yeah, and I guess that's what I was kind of going with, was she, her name's on it, but she's not necessarily the good guy.
I think a lot of probably the criticism that...
Either.
a lot of the criticism this comic has got is not necessarily because of the comic itself, but it's because it came out a week after Red Hood and Catwoman, where to a much lesser extent the female characters in those comics aren't, there's no real attempt or very little attempt and very little success at making them real people and with, you know, real thoughts and real feelings and things like that. And people open the first page of this issue and see another scantily clad woman and make that assumption that based on, you know, the previous week's stuff, that it's another one of those things. And they have to really kind of read the comic and get into it to see that that's not the direction that it goes in. And I think that the fact that it's set in a strip club, which makes sense in terms of the story, is suffering just because of the timing more than anything else.
I think there's certainly a perfect storm aspect to it, but I'm not so naive to think that that the first issue of Voodoo wouldn't have ruffled some feathers if we didn't have the controversy of the previous week. I'm sure it still would. But, you know, look, the story is there for you to grasp it if you want to, or ignore it if you want to. And I'm not saying that one is better than the other. To me, there's a curious mindset that I think you see in comics more than a lot of other media, that these comics have to be for me. They should be what I want them to be. I use the example, like, I wouldn't walk across the street to see Justin Bieber sing. I just don't care. It's not my thing. I ignore it completely.
Would you think that's something more of fandom in general, though?
You know, I think it's to a greater degree in comics because there are shared universes and shared histories almost. I think you probably see it in something like soap operas, where there's an ongoing daily or weekly relationship with the characters, so that ultimately the audience starts to feel more ownership of the characters than, you know, the people who actually own them, or the current crop of creators.
I mean, that's totally true, and it's also because, you know, creators, and the comparison between soaps and comics would be also because creators like yourself are not, like, playing all high and mighty and ignoring the fans, and, you know, for that we're glad. But I think it also shows that, again, like, everything you're writing is in the context of everything else that's happened in the DC universe at all the time, you know. I'm one of the people who read the voiceover in the beginning as being, like, your critique of the assumed, like, teenage boy audience.
It was really more
meant as a critique of the point of view of all the people sitting in that club, and frankly, most of the men in the issue. I don't think you want to read too much into it beyond that. Ultimately, once it leaves my hands, everybody's free to form their own conclusions. But I know there have been discussions of, you know, strip clubs as you know, bastions of female empowerment and blah blah blah, and I think that's all bullshit too. I have to admit that I've been to a strip club once or twice in my life, not in years, frankly. But what I picked up from, you know, bachelor parties and stuff like that was that, by and large, the men are assholes and the women are much more in control of the situation than the men are. Now, I'm not saying that strip clubs aren't, you know, nasty places and that the women get treated, you know, the way they're supposed to be in them and all that shit. Certainly. But I think in that context, the women are really in control of what's going on, at least in the club itself. And I tried to reflect a little bit of that and just show that, you know, a lot of guys who end up in strip clubs are kind of assholes or lonely or at the very least, Sad Sax. So,
how familiar with you were you with the character of Voodoo before writing this, or like how much research and past reading did you have to do before you sat down to write it?
You know, I was familiar. I've done a number of things in the Wildstorm universe in the past. I don't think I ever specifically wrote Voodoo except for a couple of crossovers, like big crossover issues. But I was familiar, you know, specifically with, you know, really the Alan Moore stuff, which I think really, not the Voodoo miniseries as much as his work on Wildcats, which, you know, really kind of gave you that other aspect of Voodoo, which is her being the, really fleshed out that aspect of Voodoo of her being half alien and you know, the Daemonites being kind of ghettoized on their alien worlds because of the Intergalactic War and all that stuff. So I was familiar with all that stuff, and then I tossed it out the window and sat down and kind of started from square one, because I wanted to do a take on the character that was accessible for the audience and didn't depend at all on what had gone before.
It seems like Grifter also seems to have to do with the Daemonites, and they both came from the Wildstorm. Is there any talk between you and the writer of that to make sure both on the same page?
I looked at the first couple of issues, you know, the outline for Grifter, but I think really the idea is to, you know, keep these books separate at least for now so that they can stand on their own and establish their own, you know, their own personality, their own personality and setting, supporting cast. I think it's important to build all that stuff early on. If down the road we can, you know, we can do something where the characters end up meeting, I think that would be great. But I think that, you know, the knee-jerk thing is, oh, hey, let's, they're both from the Wildstorm universe, let's put them together.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to do that, I would think.
So I'd like to stay back, you know, stay away from that for at least a little while.
Right. And what can we expect from the, like, how long does the first arc go?
You know, most of the first six issues are really kind of single-issue stories that move her character forward and put some more flesh on the bones of the Agent Fallon character, who will very much be a recurring presence in the series. But, you know, it's not like issue one is part one of six. I felt like I wanted to make each issue kind of at least as much as possible satisfying in and of itself, so that, you know, you felt like the readership feels like it's getting a decent chunk every time we put 20 pages in front of them.
It was interesting that one thing I thought about was with Witchblade. I know a lot of people think of it itself as a like a TNA comic in a way, but there you have a strong female lead, single mom, superhero, cop, trying to have a relationship. Like it's actually a fully fleshed out character, and the Agent Fallon. Do you see any similarities between the two, other than they're just both female cops in a way? Do you think one kind of influences the other? Right.
I think Sarah is, despite the burden of the Witchblade, I think she's kind of got her shit together. Agent Fallon, as the series goes on, how do I want to say this without revealing too much? She's got some baggage and some flaws.
Just sort of hint at in the first issue.
I was going to say, that's there. You're not giving anything away.
That will, you know, that will flesh themselves out. And again, you know, my approach to the book was that I didn't want to have, you know, the white hats and the black hats. I wanted Voodoo as well as Fallon and the people that she works for to be somewhat sympathetic and to have certain aspects that were off-putting. And how I want both of the main characters, because I consider Fallon a main character as well as Voodoo, I want both of the main characters to actually have arcs and to grow in believable ways, rather than just kind of treading water.
Has Fallon been in anything else, or was that a brand new character?
No, we just made her up.
All right. I'm like not a huge DC reader before this, so I just feel like I need to ask this every time I start reading something. Like, hey, is this a new person or not?
Well, I think that's to some extent that's the beauty of the relaunch, is that you don't need to know anything, or at least you shouldn't need to know anything about this stuff. You know, my book or any of the others. And I know there are some books that have a little bit more of a tie to what's gone before, but in this situation, doing a book that's really not that hasn't had a life before is kind of cool, because we can just make stuff up.
Anything else you want to plug? Anything else coming up? New series or Shinku number? I think 3 should be coming up soon.
Shinku 3 will be out soon, followed shortly thereafter by 4. We've got them both. Since 3 is complete and 4 is four or five pages from complete, and we're sort of in a holding pattern right now because the colorist on Shinku had some health concerns himself, as well as fairly serious health concerns in his family, and we ultimately made the decision, look, do what you got to do. We'll get to the book as soon as humanly possible, but you know, it's more important that he takes care of his family.
Oh, absolutely.
Deals with the situations, and we'll get the book out as soon as we can. So that will unfold. We're hoping to get both 3 and 4 out in October, and I don't think that's going to happen. So it'll probably be 3 in October and 4 in November.
Any other questions from Alana or Ken? Comments?
You know, I'm going to have a hard time picking up 4.
we're just getting our sleeves rolled up. I'm, you know, I hope Alana doesn't feel like I'm not sympathetic to her concerns. I just feel like there's pro and cons on both sides of this argument. And I think people get so, you know, and I don't, by people, I don't mean Alana. I mean, people get so soapboxy about this stuff, and they really don't want to have a discussion. They want to have a monologue. And I think ultimately that doesn't do anybody any good.
Well, it's an interesting on the discussion is DC did tweet up one comment of saying, like, we heard from you. And then another that said there's ratings on these, and the ratings one I thought was a little tone deaf to what the actual issue
because
was.
Because they're very inconsistent as to what they mean for which
well,
rating.
I think the rating thing was really in response to the lady who was showing her 7-year-old.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure that was and I think that's what it was as well. But do you know, is there going to be discussions afterwards of like, do they circle back with you and say, because none of us have created comics, so none of us know the process of it. Do they circle back with you at a point and say, here's what the feedback is?
There's always an ongoing discussion of any of this stuff. Ultimately, you know, how the books sell is number one on the list of what really affects books. But you also have to keep in mind that, you know, we're basically work on an issue 4.
Right.
You know, so essentially, you know, before issue 1 ever hit the stands, you know, 2 and 3 are in the can as far as, you know, the art, maybe the color is still being worked out, but a lot, you know, so we're working a few months ahead on stuff. So it's not like you're going to see on any book, and I don't just mean Voodoo or anything else. It's not like you're going to see immediate, you know, if somebody goes nuts about issue A, you're not going to see, you know, an immediate reaction because a lot of this stuff is already done. But I think, you know, I think on all of this stuff, I think the discussion is good. The diatribes aren't so great because I think it polarizes things. to the extent that, that people don't want to look at the other side and have an understanding of the issue as a whole, rather than just this is my standpoint and that's the way it is.
Female fans have been told to shut up and be okay with the way things are for a long time, though. I mean, I don't believe in going on diatribes because it's not helpful, but by the publishers, that, you know, if you don't like it, go elsewhere, and, you know, there's, and also just by a lot of the critics
specifically who?
Like, the individual, I mean, mostly it's places I don't read anymore, but there's a history of us being told that we should just be quiet and not complain about it. So people are gonna say what they feel.
I think that's a generalization, and I'm not saying that you're wrong, but I'm saying that's the sort of stuff to me that says, oh well, you know, women were told to shut up. Well, you know, that's such a broad statement. Coming from like the last 10 years of my career, where a lot of my work was for CrossGen and for Top Cow, where frankly we had more female readers than I've ever seen, or than I had seen on my Marvel or DC stuff, if interactions at conventions and signings and stuff like that are any indication. So in my experience, I've been seeing more female readers on my stuff. I can't speak for anything else because I have no evidence, and certainly the only thing that I have here is anecdotal. But when I left Marvel in DC to do CrossGen stuff, I encountered more female readers than I ever had previously, and that continued on the Top Cow stuff. And I think the commonality there is they're not superhero stories. So I'm not saying that women shouldn't be reading superheroes or anything that ridiculous.
Okay, because it kind of sounded like that.
I'm sorry?
So it could sound like that,
No. Please. Let's be reasonable. I am saying that when I started writing stories that weren't centered in superhero universes, my female readership went up.
I definitely, I've heard that you get a broader readership when you have, in general, in any demographic way, when you have a more kind of range of stories. But I mean, DC definitely said like that in the relaunch. It's pretty much, with a whole couple of exceptions, it is all superhero stories. And I do think that, the fact that you see women in the numbers that you see them at the conventions, and Brett has been doing really good data analysis on Facebook to try to figure out who comic fans actually are. Like, there is a big female audience, and there is enough concern going on that they should be paying attention to it. Yeah.
Oh yeah,
and
absolutely. I've always thought that, look, for comic publishers to be ignoring half the population is one of the reasons the sales suck.
Yeah.
Now that's also comic publishers in a broad sense. If Marvel or DC, which do mostly superhero books that have been around for 40 or 50 or 60 years. I mean, those are the core characters, obviously, and most of those characters are male and appeal to a male audience. They're not going to stop doing those characters in favor of
not at all. But but Batman has a huge following among women, and a lot of these characters.
Let me finish. What I'm saying is, we need to try to do more female friendly books, I think, in those universes, and then hopefully the sales are there. Now, historically, the sales haven't been there for books that were female leads.
Why do you think that is?
I think generally the audience previously has been very male-oriented.
So, I think a lot of those books were bad. you know, and then they say, oh, it didn't sell, so people, women don't, you know, either women don't want to read comics or nobody wants to have female leads. I think a lot of them were just badly written and possibly would have been better done if they'd had some more female creators working on them.
You know, but that's undefinable, really. You know, I think there's always going to be a friction between dealing with superhero universes that have traditionally been populated by male heroes, because those are the ones that have traditionally sold, and then trying to expand those universes to a female readership. It's going to be little steps, because ultimately the publishers are interested in the bottom line.
And if
they're not making money on books that are targeted to a female audience, they're not going
to. But they never really have done that. They've whenever they've created stuff that was supposed to be for women, it was either aimed at kids, which is good. You want to aim stuff at kids also, but that wasn't aimed for adult women. Or it was not well done. I'm sorry.
DC did do Minx. And out of Minx, you had New York 4, which was Brian Wood. And New York 4 was absolutely fantastic.
Those definitely got good critical review. But
those aren't superhero books.
No. They definitely weren't. But
I think that's always I think too often when people refer to small C comics in general, what they're really talking about are Marvel and DC superhero books.
Yeah, well, that's what most people know.
There's a lot more to that out there.
Yes.
You know, when people say, why aren't there books for women? Well, you know, there are books for women. They might not be in the Marvel and DC universes.
You go out to an artist alley at a convention, you can see that there's tons of women.
And also, you know, it's a very hidebound system, because artistically, I think now we're seeing more of an influx of female artists who were influenced by manga more than American comics, and that's where some of that artistic influence comes from. If that's what you draw like, it's great, but you're probably not going to get hired via Marvel and DC.
But if their sales are bad, then they might want to consider doing things. No, I personally don't like manga, but they might want to consider, you know, trying some different things.
They
keep making the same mistake and wondering why it's not any better.
But ultimately, that, you know, if you're going to have a fairly consistent stylistic initiative across your line.
I've heard that there's a DC style.
Vertigo, had such a unique, specific feel and was a project of DC and was part of the DC universe from day one. I mean,
Vertigo's not part of the DC universe.
No, I mean, it was when it began. So it's not like they can't do projects within DC.
Well, yeah, but, I think we need to deal with the reality of right now rather than what it was like 15 years ago.
No, but it's a suggestion, actually, which I have, you know, of a one possible approach. Way to bring in more kinds of styles.
You know, I'm personally of the opinion that you're not ultimately going to sell Superman to a large female audience. Right?
Theaters.
Well, right, but, you know, but the movie theaters don't translate into comic sales anyway.
They botched that to the end, but it shows you that women will watch these movies. You know, I mean, it isn't that people aren't interested in these characters, but they're being told visually through a lot of the art that they're not supposed to be reading them. Everybody I know pretty much loves the Batman movies, for example, of any gender.
I think that's painting with a really broad brush. You know, and again, I don't think you can compare movies to comics because they're not the same thing. Millions of people will go see Batman. Millions of people will go see Spider-Man. Maybe 1% of those people will actually pick up a Batman or Spider-Man comic.
which is a problem with how they're marketed. But it means, but it shows you that women are interested in those characters. It isn't that women don't want to read those characters, because they'll see them, they'll watch those characters. They'll spend way more money going to see one movie with those characters in 3D than they are spending on a single issue of a comic, which, of course, they're not being advertised to, unfortunately, in the first place. But the point that, that women don't want to see superheroes is, I just don't think the math shows that to be the case when you look at box office.
Well, you know, I said comics and movies are different things, but you keep making, you keep referring to people seeing movies as evidence that they'll buy comics.
Well, what about
the character?
And that's been proven not to be the case for men and women.
What about books?
But it means that the character isn't the issue. It means that it's not that women don't like Batman or Superman, because they do like them in movies. And yeah, we need to like get a better job of getting people to, who watch movies to then know that there's a comic to go buy in the first place and bridge that gap for sure. But it shows that people of all different kinds are actually interested in the characters, or else they wouldn't go see the movie.
Okay, so why don't more people read Superman? Why don't more women read Superman?
Well, in part because nobody is actually trying to do anything about taking some fans of movies and turning them into fans of comics, because I don't think maybe their marketing department's asleep at the wheel. I'm sorry?
I actually think it's part of it. I mean, I've said in a post once or twice before, is I actually think there's a stigma when it comes to women reading comics. I just think there is a social stigma about it, and that's what needs to be broken through. And it has nothing to do with the fact that they wouldn't do it. I mean, I kind of brought it up and I didn't do it so eloquently in a discussion we had at one point where I brought up Twilight. And Twilight had a massive female readership. And you could really see it geared towards women readers. And that's, I wouldn't be shocked if that was the majority. If you take Twilight, the exact same thing, and it came out as a graphic novel first or a comic book series, it would have tanked. It would have absolutely tanked. So if it was the same thing but done in a comic book format, where is the Twilight, where is the Harry Potter, the things that do have a big female audience, why aren't those bigger? I mean, Buffy is like the only thing you can say is really translated from entertainment to comic and took a large chunk of the female readership with it. The Twilight graphic novel sold really, really well, but there wasn't like a continuing thing. Like as a whole, I mean, it's a weird stigma, and the conversation with the women I talk to who aren't comic book readers, to me, reinforces that, where they always have that snub thing of like, oh, you read comics, and then I go into them and be like, no, you need to read Day Tripper. This is what Day Tripper is about. And you go into the story, and it's like, wow, that sounds really interesting. And you tell them about a lot of the non-superhero stuff. That's usually how I hook them in, and I find that one thing.
That's true of non-comic book readers, period, of both genders, in my experience, is they actually, in general, they're like, they think that comics means it's something for kids, and this, you know, I think it's getting better, people are more aware, but I think that that's true with men as well who don't read comics. They have the same response.
I don't know about comics. I think it's a chicken and egg thing, really.
Yeah.
And I think, again, it's small steps, because comics are more widely available now. You can, you know, walk into a Barnes and Noble and you know, find a whole shelf of graphic novels. But ultimately, to me, superhero comics are still about people beating the crap out of each other at their base level. I think superhero comics are power fantasies. For good or ill, I think we need to expand the kinds of stories we tell with these characters if we want to bring in a more diverse audience, women included.
I agree with all of those statements, I do. But the thing I was going to say to try to connect it, though, is that let's say that DC Marketing got their act together and put a display of comic books for sale in the lobby of a movie theater where they had just shown Batman. Even if you have, you know, women who go in to see Batman because the movie is like critically acclaimed and everybody loves the character Batman, and they go out and they see a comic book display of comics right there for them to buy about the character that they just watched and enjoyed, if the comic was done the way it is done by, like, the majority of the artists right now, the comic book's cover would be screaming to the women saying, this isn't for you, this is for men to read, because of how it would have the female, if it had a female character on it, because of how the female character would be drawn, and because of the assumed male perspective of everything that happened in the book. So, you know, even if the comics did, like, the logical marketing things, which, you know, I mean, Brett has really been someone I think has had a lot of great ideas on that area, I still think that the actual content itself of what a lot, not all, but what a lot of what these comics are showing would still be telling you that these aren't for you. Even if the story that's perhaps told in it might be.
It's all supposition. I mean, ultimately, you know, like, I look at my wife, who obviously there's stacks of comics in the house all the time. She was not terribly intrigued to read, like, my superhero stuff. When I started to do something like Samurai Heaven and Earth or Witchblade, something that was not that didn't have the superhero veneer on it, she was a lot more intrigued and a lot more anxious to find out what happens next. I'm not meaning to say that my wife's tastes are every woman's tastes or every person's tastes, but I think because there's a cyclical nature to the superhero stuff, and again, a lot of it is based on the heroes and the villains fight. I think that's somewhat less interesting to not only a segment of the female audience. I think the public in general. I guess I'm saying I ultimately don't know that I don't know what the answer is in terms of what kind of stories you do to make the superheroes in the comics play to a larger audience.
So I guess the question would be: is if part of the DC relaunch, and I'm sure this is more of a throwing out there, not that I'm expecting an answer because you wouldn't know this, is if part of the DC relaunch was to get a bigger share of the market, to get more readers, to increase sales, and they clearly said that they were going to go with they've shown that they were willing to do new properties, new series, you know, Nightwing, Voodoo's, two great examples of obscure characters that they're kind of throwing out there. And superhero series don't necessarily do well with women. We're just going to say, let's say that's true. Why wasn't there a series or two that might play to female readers? Like, if you sit there and say, all right, we want to grow a bigger audience, you know, we need a diverse line, maybe we do this to hopefully get the female audience. It just seems like there's still that disconnect there. And you can't answer
obviously
that.
Obviously, that's not a question I can answer. I do know that, obviously, there's Batgirl, there's Supergirl. And again, I haven't read those issues either, so I can't speak to the tone of them and whether that they're attractive to female readers. I would hope that they are.
Female readers, no idea. They were good. I really like Batgirl, other than the whole her walking again was still an issue. And Supergirl a little bit because she's wearing a singlet seems a little awkward, but I think both are really, really well written. And I think that's part of the thing is that both those characters, for example, are characters, there's more depth to them. They're not just curves and long legs, that there's more to the character. And I think that's a lot of the issue with Catwoman and Red Hood, and I know you haven't read them, was it was all teen A. Like, there was no depth to it. It was a very one-note thing, and especially with Starfire. And hers was, go out, blow up this tank, you're going to sleep with these guys, and that was it. Like, there was just devoid of character. So, I mean, even there was, it was just strange. And this is something that, like, I'm kind of with you, Ron, where I normally do roll my eyes at this stuff, but this was just so blatant. It was so, I mean, it was very, very odd that it all kind of happened at the same time and out in the same week.
I think there's, I think it's certainly there can be a tone deafness to those concerns working in a vacuum. That's not to excuse it in any way. I'm just saying that, you know, sometimes, you know, sometimes people just don't realize what this stuff is going to seem like when it gets out onto the market. You know, in the case of Voodoo, you know, yeah, I set the first issue in a strip club because I thought it made sense for the character, and I thought it would also, you know, people, you know, look, I didn't go into this and figure, oh, well, nobody will remark upon this. I mean, obviously people are gonna talk about it, but I hoped what the audience would get out of it, and I think some have and some haven't, was that there was a specific reason that was going on, and then by the time we get to issue one, that reason is gone. You know, we're not going to go back there.
Now, yeah, it was kind of the thing that was funny about Voodoo, having read it, was by the end of the issue, it seemed like the strip club was just that issue, and it's probably not coming back again if the ending of it, and I don't want to say it, is any hint. Like, it just is almost like this traditionally was what the character was. Just kind of feels right to have her start there. It plays well for the story that you wanted to tell, and it's really one issue. Let's move on.
That was my intent, but I know, like I said, once you send this stuff out into the world, people make their own decisions about it. You know, certainly I feel like it's in the rearview mirror, and people will see what happens in issue two and how the story progresses from there. So I think it's always premature to judge an overall concept or series on one issue. I always feel like these things are, you know, it's almost like judging a book after you read the first chapter. And I know that, you know, look, we publish monthly, and that's all the audience has to go on. But I hopefully, you know, we'll get a few issues down the road, and people will have I think people who might be tweaked right now might have a different perspective on where her character goes and what she does. You know, we'll have to see. I you know, I don't quibble with anybody's right to be offended if you know, if as long as they're, you know, understanding the story that's in front of them. You know, hey, be offended if you need to be. The flip side of that coin to me is not every book is supposed to be for every person. You know, so again, I think we get back to that sense of ownership and kind of righteousness in the comic audience as a whole. I think you get, you know, you get that feedback on anything. Well, this isn't the way I want Superman to be, and that's not what I want Batman to do. You know, it's, you know, like we said, I think that closeness of the audience to the characters really, really breeds that kind of thing. And, you know, that's a knife that cuts both ways. I mean, obviously the industry as a whole is better off because of the intensity of the relationship that the real hardcore audience has with the characters. But, you know, if there's blowback from that too.
Interesting. I know, I mean, we've been going off to this, we've had tons of questions about the process and wondering somehow the process was part of the issue, and I can't remember all our discussions that we've had leading up to this.
Well, a lot of it is you're trying to figure out how much of stuff came from the publishers and how much of stuff was being left to the actual creators.
Yeah, I think that was a big question of ours was...
In my case, like I said, I sort of got a general sense of the overall tone of the book, and then I pitched them, what if we do this, this, and this, and the story goes in this direction? I can't, there are certain things that I can't reveal right now because they would ruin surprises, you know, in issues 5 and 6 and on down the road. You know, I really wanted the overall tone of the series to be that, you know, almost you should be rooting for Voodoo in some ways, but also off put by her actions in some ways. and that her character arc will eventually kind of explain some of her backstory and why she has these reactions, and maybe what kind of person she eventually grows into.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's, to me, I think with a lot of stuff that came up about Voodoo was just because of the order that it came in. If Catwoman didn't happen, if Red Hood didn't happen, there wasn't Harley Quinn wearing a corset and Amanda Waller half the woman that she was, I think most people have just read it and been like, okay, whatever. And I it's almost where I sit there and it's like, I feel bad in that it comes after all this shit storm leading up to this, where it was just like the luck of the draw of the release and it is what it is.
Sure. Well, you know, obviously context is everything. And I think,
yeah,
you know, any of these things, you know, you kind of take them one at a time and you go, oh, well, you know, I guess maybe I'm not crazy about that, but it's, you know, it's off-putting, but it's not, you know, you don't see the, you know, you don't sort of see the conspiracy theory that's now kind of being grafted onto it.
I don't think I hear people saying it's a conspiracy theory. I think people thinking it's more like people making really bad decisions.
I go with it's the conspiracy theory. Like to say that there was a, this is a, for some, I'm not saying all, but some have said, like, you know, it's odd that there's all these issues coming out about female characters. They all kind of are with this relaunch. Like, there had to be some sort of conscious effort of this is how we're going to display and portray.
Well, I would say neglect. It's more like deliberate neglect, like just saying, you know what, we're just not going to care about this issue at all. But I don't know. I mean, if you think that people are talking like there's a conspiracy, I think it's more like a, you know, we're supposed to be rethinking things, but we've decided to do them exactly the same way we always have and look for different results.
No, I don't mean
conspiracy
in that sense.
It's more
just,
like a big accident.
I just mean, I think, you know, again, people cherry pick the evidence to indicate the vast right wing conspiracy, as Clinton used to say. I think he can connect things that aren't necessarily connected. And make a, you know, sort of make more of a mosaic out of it than is really there. And I'm not trying to dismiss the concerns as a whole or even individually. I'm just saying that I think sometimes the audience gets ahead of itself in kind of coming up with theories of how, you know, of how this all comes together. You know, I mean, certainly until Catwoman and Red Hood hit the stands, I had no idea what was in them. You know, and that's generally how, you know, how the creators are, and we're all kind of on our own islands, and when we need to know stuff about other books, we're brought into the circle. But for the most part, we do what we do, in a bit of a vacuum.
And you don't go out. I mean, you said you haven't read Red Hood, you haven't read Catwoman. You don't go out and see what all the other folks are doing. You just kind of focused on your stuff and don't have time to even do that.
Well, if it's necessary to, you know, if you're going to do some sort of crossover or something like that, or the mysterious hooded figure that's in all the books.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously that was handed down from.
Do you know what the Do you know what that is?
I know more than you do. you know, that sort of stuff is played out, but I think one of the more interesting things about this relaunch is that the books really are kind of standing separately when we've come through a period of comics really being, you know, the universe ultimately being the storytelling unit rather than individual issues, because comics have been so, you know, and by comics, I'm doing the same thing everybody else does. I mean, the Marvel and DC superhero universes have really been this ongoing series of universe-wide stories. And with the relaunch, I think we're kind of getting back to books that are a little bit more individual and stand on their own, which I think is ultimately a really good thing. I think forcing the readership to buy all the titles to keep up with a huge ongoing story is a trick you can only do for so long, and eventually the audience gets really tired of it.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Other than The Hooded Woman.
Well, you know, I think that's kind of a way to, you know, and again, I know a little bit more about it, but I can't say anything about it. But I think that there is, it's kind of a neat, it's a neat way to connect the whole universe, give it a feeling of connection,
yeah,
without bogging it down in, you know, myriad threads of continuity and all that. So I think it's a cute nod, but it doesn't interfere with your enjoyment of the individual issues.
I mean, the one thing I would say about the character is, I mean, my fear is that whatever she is going to lead into yet a company cross-wide event in 2012 or 2013 or whatever. But the one thing I do like about it is that she brings in the DC New at the end of Flashpoint. And it seems that she pops up right about when something big with the character is about to come on, like the first time they switch and, you know, their powers emerge, or there's some big life-changing event, where that's where she seems to pop up in these first issues, which is nice. Like, it does feel like there's continuity, they're connected, but they're not, don't necessarily are connected all the time. It's just a really nice touch.
Yeah, you know, this is the kind of stuff that I think kind of works, that makes a shared universe work. And, you know, and as with all things, I mean, a shared universe is a great tool that you can use to tell your story. But if you let it become the chief motivation of telling your story, then, you know, then it's kind of, you're letting it overstep its bounds. So to me, this is it's got a nice feel to it. It's got a nice limited feel to it.
And so, and it kept up sticking out to me the couple times I've seen the Top Cow panels at various conventions, that you guys really stick with that, is that you've made a point of the thing like Artifacts, where you can just read the 13 issues of Artifacts and understand the events. If you want to read more, it's great in that you'll get a greater sense, but you're not less for you know, just sticking with that main event book. And I think a lot of other companies have been failing in that recently, where it's too bogged down. There are key events, key things that happen in an issue here or issue there in another series, or the top series add no value to it and really just feel like a money grab.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, our, you know, the way we've approached things at Top Cow is that we want the reader who is sort of reading across the whole line to be rewarded for that.
Yeah.
But we don't want to penalize anyone who isn't reading across the whole line. You should get your full story experience if you're just reading one or two titles, as opposed to, you know, four or five or however many are involved.
And I think the perfect example is you had Artifacts with Sarah's sister getting killed in I think that's the first issue. And then it was like one or two issues of Witchblade later was just her reflecting on that and talking to a police psychologist.
It wasn't a necessity.
Exactly. But it was still a very powerful issue in that, you know, unto itself. Like, you could read that issue by itself and walk away and say, holy crap, it's really good, tied in with the Artifacts, because you could see you saw the brutality of what happened. And you're like, wow, that's, you know, that's amazing as well, is that you could go either or. Like, I'm even more impressed by that, is that you could just pick up that one issue of Witchblade, read it, and say, this is fantastic unto itself, where it could just be a issue of a sister, you know, a woman losing her sister, even knowing nothing about what happened in Artifacts.
Well, that's the craft of it, really. And I'm, you know, I'm not saying that to pat myself on the back. I'm saying that. That's the way.
I'm saying you on the back, like it's nutty.
I mean, I'm saying that's the way comics, to my mind, should work. Is that, you know, if you just want to read one issue or one series, you should be able to do that and not feel like you're missing anything. And there are certainly, you know, there are ways to make that work, but it's just, you know, you have to walk a little bit finer line than you do when you're just telling whatever story you feel like. So, you know, it's really a matter of the craft of putting the story together so that it's accessible to the longtime reader, as well as somebody who might be picking up their first issue. And that certainly used to be something that was drilled into your heads as a creator at Marvel and DC, you know, a number of years ago. It's the, you know, the old chestnut every issue is somebody's first. So certainly, you know, 30 years ago, it was much more didactic. You got the summation of a character's powers and origin somewhere in the first few pages of the issue every damn time. And that was really a reflection of the fact that the audience was always changing and the kids were picking up these books off the newsstand, so you had to make them welcoming experiences because more often than not, you weren't putting an issue one in front of them. The market has changed so that you're dealing with a lot of longtime readers who are frankly going to get bored if you're doing a lot of that in every issue, who are going to feel like, well, I don't need the recap. I've been reading this damn book for 5 years. The function of that is that it, you know, you end up catering to the audience you have and not catering to the audience that you want or the audience that you need to bring in on a regular basis to, you know, keep the fire stoked. You need to bring in new readers to replace the ones that you lose.
And it's interesting, I'll just outright say it, is to me that's the difference between people who just kind of write stories that are easy to pick up and people who are clearly writing for the trade, where trade is you're getting a part of a story. If you miss that first part or the second part or the third part, you might as well not read the fourth and fifth parts because you're not going to have a clue what's going on. And it's interesting in watching the various companies of how they're doing it, is some very much have stuck to the I'm writing to the trade because trade paperback graphic novels are still selling fairly well, whereas others are kind of mixing it up, doing one shots here and there. Somewhat it's written for the trade, but so at the same time you can still hop in a little bit. It's just very. It's blatant, and it's funny, is out of the years that I've read it, I mean, I've read comics for 20-something years, I've just really started noticing it, of how blatant it is between various companies.
Well, I think it's a, you know, part of it is just a function of the decompression of stories now, which I don't think is a great thing. I think there are ways that you can make each individual issue feel like a satisfying chunk and then make them all work together to make a larger story and a more satisfying story in the trade. And again, it's not brain surgery, but it is a matter of craft and kind of understanding that you're actually serving two audiences. You're serving the monthly audience and you're serving the trade audience who might buy this, 3 years from now in a trade. Without any, without the benefit of reading prior issues, so it's I think it's certainly something that we as an industry need to do a better job of. I mean, if we're going to stick to monthly issues as the chief delivery form, whether it's digital or print. We have to make the individual issues more accessible and more satisfying.
Actually, I think it's a good question to come up since you just brought up digital. Is digital changing the way you write at all? I mean, the one thing I noticed is it hasn't yet, but I imagine it's got to at some point change the way artists do, because right now two-page spreads don't work very well on most digital devices.
It's not really changing what I do now, but I think the double page spread is the big bugaboo. It's the one that you really have to, it works great in the comic. It works great. There's a big double page spread in issue 3 of Voodoo, that's, you know, it's a big deal, big shot, special effects-y kind of image that deserved a double-page spread. However, as I was writing it, I thought to myself, well, how is this actually going to play digitally? And I, you know, I got some Twitter feedback the other day from somebody who had read Voodoo digitally and read it panel by panel rather than page by page. So I was curious as to how that experience played out and whether the page turn moments that you get at the bottom of hopefully every page or at least every other page in an issue translate to that kind of digital experience. So and the feedback that I got was that, you know, those moments are still there, but they're not, you know, they're obviously not at the bottom of a quote-unquote page, because if you're going through it panel by panel, you sort of get that cliffhanger image every so often rather than driving you through a page turner of an issue.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's one. I mean, I personally do notice a difference. I mean, there's some comics that I've read digitally and that I picked up a print copy of it because I really liked it and wanted to see how it translated. And there is a hell of a difference at times. And there's been some, I mean, most of the stuff I read and when I review them are digitally. And there's been a couple series that just haven't translated well to digital medium. And when I read it, I was like, this is horrible. You can't read the art, the text for the dialogue, you can't read, like, it just doesn't, basically just doesn't translate well. But when you pick up a print version, it's a totally different experience. I mean, it's something I imagine you're going to see a lot of evolution over the next couple of years as people try to figure that out. And I'm wondering,
I absolutely hope so, because I ultimately think that the delivery vehicle is important, and, you know, that should dictate the style. I think double page spreads work great in single issue comics. They work a little less great on a trade paperback because you're losing stuff in the seam of where the issue is put together. They work even less great digitally. Although you can obviously, you know, turn your iPad on its side and get that sort of widescreen image. But I do think ultimately the digital delivery mechanism will dictate changes in the way we do the books. As digital becomes more prevalent, I think you'll see more and more content skewed for the digital delivery rather than the print delivery. And I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing. I think comics, just like anything else, will ultimately go where the money is and where the sales are. And if digital really takes off, you'll see more and more content specifically designed for the digital. And then, you know, the collected version of that will reflect that digital portal.
Well, I know we're well over time of our usual length, Alana. It has to go, so I don't know if you have any last questions or you want to say anything, Alana, before you actually bolt.
No, but thank you for coming and speaking with us. I might not agree with you, but I think it's good that you're having this conversation.
Oh, I think it's great that it's a conversation rather than just, you know, kind of, I was going to say two camps, but I think it's ultimately even more camps than that, that just sort of talk over each other and don't take the time to examine the other side's point of view. And I think it's certainly a complex issue that doesn't have any easy answers. I do think for every one step back, and I think we've seen some steps back recently, we take two steps forward maybe in another place. So hopefully the forward motion continues.
Okay. Well, thank you again. Talk to you all later.
Sure thing.
Yeah, appreciate it. I guess before we wrap up, so you're going to be at New York Comic Con, right?
I will not. I will actually be
I forgot.
Comic-Con.
You did tell me about that. Okay, damn. I was going to say I would see you then. Anything else you want to kind of promote, wrap up, or anything before we wrap up?
You know, I'm sure there's other stuff, but it's not in my head right now. I think obviously the conversation is ultimately the past couple of weeks dominated by, look what you did to these female characters. So hopefully something constructive comes out of it. I ultimately don't know that that there's this that there's I don't know I just I tend to get my back up when people, you know, like cling to, well, this is the way it is, and why isn't this book for me? Because I think that ultimately comes down to just a different version of, well, you know, I liked it when Superman had his underwear on the outside of his costume. So I hope we can, as an industry, you know, not get caught up in the details, but sort of see the broader picture.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with you on that. It's definitely, as for as much of a negative conversation as it's been over the last couple of weeks, there's been a lot of positive about it as well that I think is overlooked. That there is some fantastic female writers, artists out there, and then actually some great portrayals of women as well. I keep on pointing, for everyone that said something about Voodoo, I kept on saying, I was like, well, why haven't you been praising Witchblade over the years? Which I think is a fantastic portrayal of a female lead in a comic book series.
I think a lot of that stuff is impression is one thing and reality is often another. And in the mind of people, you know, readers, non-readers, men, women, everybody, the impression of what a series is often more important to them than what the reality of a series is. We certainly faced that with Witchblade, where we kind of had to, you know, it was and still is a one reader at a time kind of thing, where you actually have to get them to look at the material to actually go, oh, well, this isn't what I thought it was. Like I said, things get painted with a broad brush, and, you know, sometimes fairly, sometimes unfairly.
Yeah, absolutely don't disagree on that. So, unless you want to keep on talking, we've been going on for over an hour.
No, I've got scripts to finish. I should. I
was about to say, I'm sure you got stuff that. Yeah, you know, DC's threatening that if you guys don't get your stuff in time, you're gonna get booted. So, don't want to. I don't want to be the reason for that.
we don't want that to happen.
No, not at all. Because I will say my fear, I said it earlier, was I thought Voodoo was really good, and I actually think all three of us think Voodoo is really, really well. And my fear is that it's a solid series that's going to get overlooked because of what others have done and not judged on its own merits, which I think it's why I understand why people might have, gone back and being like, ooh, once you actually read through it, I think it's there's nothing to fear, and it's actually a really solid portrayal. You've got two female leads in the comic. And, you know, looking past the art or the covers or whatever, like, it's just a great story. So I'm definitely looking forward to number two and seeing what else you got.
I'm glad you guys checked out the story and, you know, for what it was rather than hey, look at what this first page looks like. I mean, sometimes story-wise, you want to let readers think a story is one thing, and then by the time they get to the end of it, they find out it's actually something else.
Yeah, and out of everyone, I think you're going to pull that off really, really nice, knowing having read a lot of your other stuff. So. So once again, I want to thank you for coming on. I really appreciate your first guest. So hopefully you'll either get more people interested or we scare the crap out of everyone else. They'll never come on.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate the discussion. I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah, appreciate it. And I guess go finish some scripts so we can get Voodoo number 2 and everything else you're going to be releasing over the next couple of months.
Busy.
Yeah, and hopefully you do
all
well
right,
in your fantasy football. All right, talk to you later.
Bye.
And again, we want to thank Ron Mars for joining us in a very extended, long episode of Graphic Policy Radio. Episode will be posted tomorrow at some point. So, as always, thanks for listening, and we want to thank Ron again for coming on board, and thanks for the other listeners or other hosts, Alana and Ken dropped off. I think they had some phone issues. So, as always, thanks for listening.